The church was as it should be. The men did preach, the women cook and sew. But now the change is here, and we can all see we're not going back to days of long ago.
So, you know, maybe that gets kind of prime the pump for what you could do. Now I got another kind of submission here. This is satire or irony of another kind. How great these days when we can sing your praises and use the words we use throughout the day, and terms like thy and thou and other phrases we can cut out and freely throw away. And I don't know if this kind of scans for the chorus or not. Let's see. The words we use to sing our... No, I think it's the words we use to sing our thankfulness. It didn't quite scan. They are words... No, maybe this does go with the chorus. I don't know. The words we use to sing our thankfulness, they are our words from work and play. The other ancient sayings of the past, throw them away, throw them away. This sounds to me like it requires antiphonal singing. You know, you've got the people on the one hand singing these stanzas, and then these somewhat critical of that perspective from the other side of the building. But we'll see what we come up with. I don't know.
I'll buy a dozen copies if you have.
But I invite any of you, if you're inspired to, we don't have one specifically about translations of Scripture yet, and there may be any number of other changes. Oh, Holy Communion, you know, nothing on communion frequency. I think that'd be a fruitful one, possibly. Anyway, if you're moved to write a stanza about something that's involved, that seems to fit, by all means, give it a try, and we'll see. We'll get our panel of judges out to pick out the stanzas, and then we'll, that's what I don't know what to do next. Whether somebody's going to stand up and sing this sometime, I don't know. Maybe July 4th is a time when you could do something like that. Okay, let's begin our official class. I'm Morris Wee. I'm a parish pastor in Northfield, Minnesota, and this is the session on Joseph. We've been looking at the story of Joseph, Genesis 37 to 50, the Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week, and today, and we'll conclude it tomorrow. I know many of you have not been able to be here at some of these sessions, so first of all, I'm going to summarize as quickly as I can what happened in the first three parts of this story, and we'll look at this one today, and we'll try to have some discrete conclusion to draw, and yet I hope you'll be able to come back tomorrow for the ending of the story too. And interrupt me at any point for questions or comments of your own. At the beginning of the story, we find that Joseph is favored by his father and hated by his brothers for that reason. He has a dream in which the sun and the moon and the stars bow down before him. The sheaves that his brothers are working on bow down before him. This angers them. And one time he comes out to see how they're doing in the field, and they decide to kill him. However, Reuben the eldest and Judah persuade or argue not to kill him, but just throw him in the pit, and finally they decide to sell him to traders who are passing by, and he's sold down into Egypt and taken down to Egypt. When he arrives in Egypt, he is sold to a man named Potiphar, and very quickly proves to be a good steward, for God is with him. Potiphar puts everything in his household in Joseph's charge, and things go beautifully until Potiphar's wife falls for Joseph and tries to seduce him. He resists, and she gets angry, rips his garment off of him, and after he leaves, argues, uses this as proof that he's attacked her, and frames him so that he's thrown into prison. He gets into prison, and the Lord is with him, and everything flourishes as well as it can in prison, and he's put in charge of all the prisoners, or whatever he can be in charge of when you're a prisoner. And the jailer trusts him completely. Then shortly, or at some point, the baker and the chief cupbearer of the Pharaoh are in prison. They have dreams. Joseph interprets the dreams correctly and tells the baker, or the cupbearer, when you're back in the Pharaoh's favor, remember me. Well, he forgets him. And it's only 2 years later, when the Pharaoh has a confusing dream, that the cupbearer remembers, tells him about this man in prison. Joseph is brought out, interprets the dream, tells Pharaoh there are going to be 7 years of good crops and 7 years of famine, and then, unsolicited, comes up with a suggestion. Here's what you should do. Put somebody in charge of all the grain, save it up, so you'll have some for the second 7 years. And Pharaoh puts Joseph in charge of that project, and it goes beautifully. And after the famine arrives, all the world is coming to Egypt for grain. Lo and behold, Joseph's family too. And so his brothers arrive before him. He recognizes them immediately, but decides not to reveal himself to them. Instead, he says, "You're spies." He throws them in jail and tells them that they have to leave one of their brothers in jail and go back and bring back their youngest, Benjamin. Benjamin, the other son of Rachel, as Joseph was a son of Rachel, the favored wife. Benjamin, therefore, presumably the other, well, clearly the other favorite of their father. So they go back. Jacob won't let them take Benjamin down there. So they have to wait, leaving their brother Simeon in jail in Egypt. And finally, Jacob relents. They're hungry enough, and they bring Benjamin back. And when Joseph sees his brothers with Benjamin, he invites them all to dinner at his home. He gives Benjamin 5 times as much food as he gives the other brothers. Then he sends them back with food. Well, that's where we take up at the beginning of chapter 44. Let's read chapters 44 and 45 straight through. Our volunteers, please.
Then he commanded the steward of his house,
"Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain."
And he did as Joseph told him. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their asses. When they had gone but a short distance from the city, Joseph said to his steward,
"Follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you returned evil for good? Why have you stolen my silver cup? Is it not from this that my lord drinks, and by this that he divines? You have done wrong in so doing.'"
When he overtook them, he spoke to them these words. They said to him,
"Why does my lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants that they should do such a thing. Behold, the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then should we steal silver or gold from your lord's house? With whomever of your servants it be found, let him die, and we also will be my lord's slaves."
He said,
"Even so, in accordance with your words, let it be. He with whom it is found shall become my slave, but the rest of you shall go free."
Then every man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and every man opened his sack. And he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes, and every man loaded his ass, and they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there, and they fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to them,
"What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed divine?"
And Judah said,
"What shall we say to my lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my lord's slaves. both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found.
But he said,
far be it from me.
Oh, no, that's Joseph.
Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose head the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father.
Then Judah went up to him and said,
oh, my lord, let your servant, I pray you, speak a word in my lord's ears, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my lord, we have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. And his brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children. And his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes upon him. We said to my lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. Then you said to your servant, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord. And when our father said, go again, buy us a little food, we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring down my gray hairs in sorrow to Sheol. Now therefore, when I come to your servant my father, and the lad is not with us, then, as his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant our father with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became surety for the lad to bring my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now therefore, let your servant, I pray you, remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord. And let the lad go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the lad is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would come upon my father.
Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried,
may everyone go out from me.
So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers,
I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?
But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers,
come near to me, I pray you.
And they came near, and he said,
I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Make haste and go up to my father, and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me. You and your children and your children's children and your flocks, your herds and all that you have, and there I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of the brother and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speak, that it is my mouth that speak to you. You must tell my father of all my splendor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Make haste and bring my father down here. Then he fell
upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them, and after that his brothers talked with him. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. And Pharaoh said to Joseph,
say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households, and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. Command them also, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones, and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Give no thought to your goods, for the best of all of the land of Egypt is yours.
The sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them he gave festal garments, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 festal garments. To his father he sent as follows, 10 asses loaded with the good things of Egypt, and 10 she-asses loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and they departed. As they departed, he said to them,
do not quarrel on your way.
So they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. And they told him,
Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And
his heart fainted, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said,
it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.
Okay, thank you very much. This is the culmination of the long test that Joseph puts to the brothers, or puts them to. It's followed with not quite as focused a section of this story. Tomorrow we'll look at some bits and pieces. We will not be reading the last 5 chapters of Genesis tomorrow, but we will read the portions that are important for the concluding of the story, which involves the death of Jacob. We said that this story was the story of the family of Jacob, and that is what it proves to be. Quite a bit of family dynamics involved, not just between Joseph and his brothers, but also between them and their father. This section begins with the culmination of Joseph's testing. The first time the brothers come down, he sends them back with money in their sacks and their request to bring Benjamin back, and they're dismayed to find the money, and they return the money. And when they come back and bring additional money as well and bring Benjamin. And so now, just to clarify what he's done, he puts the money in their sacks again when he sends them back home the second time. He puts his special cup, easily identified, in the sack of Benjamin, and sends them off. And as soon as they're out of town, he sends a steward after to arrest them for stealing this cup. So far, it's continuous, although it intensifies this kind of test, similar to what he's done before. Notice how the brothers react here. At verse 13, soon as the cup is found in Benjamin's sack, the brothers tear their clothes. Now you remember, some of you have been here all the way since Monday, it seems like weeks ago. tearing of the clothing, which is a traditional reaction of dismay in many portions of the Bible, was repeated a number of times as soon as Joseph was lost in chapter 37. His father tears his clothes, his brother tears his clothes, Joseph's own garment is presumably torn. They assume that Joseph has been torn. Well, they do this again. No mention of any words to Benjamin. I find this curious. You know, they are nervous about, to begin with, about how Joseph is treating them. They're worried about finding this money in their sack the first time. So the father sends all these gifts and everything. And in fact, it's to back up just a second, at verse 8 and following, their response is so confident that they could have done no wrong that they say, well, you know, if any of us should have done this, let him be killed and the rest of us will be your slaves. They're sure that they haven't done anything wrong. And that confidence of their not doing evil strikes me as a very human reaction, and something that's very common. I find that in myself. I come to the confession in worship and I think, I've been trying pretty hard, you know, I'm doing okay. Why do I have to go through this confession? I think that's often a human reaction, other people need the confession worse than we do. But at any rate, I just wanted to draw your attention to the confidence of the brothers. They are a bunch of characters and they've done a lot of stuff, but they're sure in this case that nobody's done anything. And of course, there's the cup in Benjamin's sack. And they, as we've seen, they have some reason to be envious of Benjamin, as they had been of Joseph. We don't see it reflected here. Their first reaction is just to be dismayed, and they return to Joseph. And look at Judah's words in verse 16. What can we say? What can we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. He doesn't say, but we're innocent. He doesn't have a conversation with Benjamin and find out that Benjamin has no idea where this cup came from, and then come back to Joseph and say, we don't get it, which is what they said about the money. No, he says, we're guilty. The evidence is so clear about the cup that there's no point in arguing against it, perhaps. But probably the deeper meaning is that just as when they first ran into trouble with Joseph, they said, God is doing this to us because of what we did to our brother. Here, Judah comes out and says this to the one who has power over him. We're guilty. And very curious. I try to imagine being in that situation myself, where I was utterly without fault with regard to taking the cup and being able to recognize that this is about something bigger and I'm guilty. So at any rate, that's where Judah starts, and he says, we're all your slaves. Not just Benjamin, but all of us. And Joseph says, no, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that to you. Just the guy who stole it is the one who's going to have to remain and be my slave. And then we get this wonderful speech of Judah's that starts in verse 18. And just a reminder of the sequence of his argument. He starts out, it's a long narrative he gives here. And he reviews the history. But what he focuses on is his relationship to his father. And starting at verse 27, you know my wife bore me two sons. This is the father speaking, he's recalling this. One has left me, I said, surely he's been torn to pieces. Remembering that fear and assumption on the part of Jacob.
Well, you know, there's something about you that is, even though he's painted up as the most favoring of people, he certainly does have a sensitivity and a for his father, it seems to me.
Judah, here.
Judah.
Indeed.
Judah,
yeah. Yeah.
Certainly an empathy of his feelings, it seems to me, like,
right.
Which is quite touching.
Yeah, it is. It's very touching here.
Because everyone, you know, has this feeling toward their parents.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this is what a total contrast this is to Judah's and the other brothers' response at the time they sold Joseph into slavery. Not once did they mention their father or how their father might feel about this at that time. But now, having lived with their guilt about that for 20 years or more, having recognized what it did to their father, this time, when the same situation is before them, Judah's first thought is about his father, and he explains it at length, repeating his father's words, "If you take this one also from me and harm comes to him, you will bring down my gray hairs in sorrow to Sheol." The first time when Joseph was supposedly killed, he said, "I will go down to Sheol to my son mourning." That is, I will mourn for the rest of my life. This time he said, if Benjamin goes, I'm going to die. I'm going to Sheol. And Judah repeats that and summarizes it in this way. Then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, when he sees the boy is not with us, he will die. So Judah begins arguing for compassion for his father and displaying a great deal of compassion for his father. Then after that he says, "I promised. I am surety for him. I promised to bring him back. So take me in his place." And concludes at verse 34, "How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me?" So different from their perspective before. Although you remember, "lad" is your translation in the RSV, and in chapter 37, the only time they call Joseph a lad is after they've sold him into slavery, and they start to feel what they've done, and they say, "Where are we going to go? What have we done to them?"
Joseph pushed it about as far as he could there.
Pushed what?
Joseph pushed them, his brothers, about as far as he thought he needed to do it.
In this testing here?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
In the testing.
Right.
He pushed them up. He got all these confessions out of them.
Right. That's something I'd like to have us discuss a little bit in a few minutes, is why, what's accomplished by all of this process that he puts them through, and is there additional growth on the part of the brothers or Joseph that brings them to the point of reconciliation? Because we mentioned the other day, somebody mentioned, the reason that he delays revealing his identity is because there's a need, this is a major breach in the family, and there's a need for a process of reconciliation to take place. And so the assumption would be that what he puts them through then develops the reconciliation process. And I'd like us in a minute to discuss that, but I just want to kind of work through a couple more details about what happens here. Just get them out in the open, and then we'll talk about that question. Joseph can't control himself, and so begins to weep. And the other chapters we saw, that's his one open, overt reaction is weeping, and we have to understand what causes the weeping. Joseph reveals himself to the brothers and right away tells them, "Don't be distressed or angry with yourselves that you sold me here. God sent me before you to preserve life." God intended this. And then he tells them the third time, it's not you who sent me here, but God, the third time, "Tell Jacob, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt." Attributing these things to God and taking the brothers off the hook for it. Kind of interesting, given that we were feeling he was enjoying the control he had over them and making them squirm a little bit. As soon as he reveals himself to them, he says, "Don't worry about it. God intended this."
Actually, he said it four times. not just three times. He said it four times.
That God did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, is the fourth time right here? Yeah, right. It is. Thank you. This thing, he comes back in chapter 50 and he says it again, the part we always read in church. Thank you. A little note about the relationships. Verse 12, he's talking to his brothers and he says, now your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin, making a distinction between some of the brothers and his full-blooded brother Benjamin, the other child of his mother Rachel. Although at other points in here, well, I suppose when it says he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and he kissed all his brothers and wept. Benjamin is the one, all his brothers are the other ones. That's been an issue in the dynamics of this complex family all along, and it's still there. The sense that Benjamin gave to the brothers and all this silver besides. The test is over, right? The test is over. He doesn't need to find out how they're going to treat Benjamin anymore, but he still does it, which raises the question of why, what his motive has been. Excuse me, please.
What is festal? F-E-S-T-A-L. What kind of a garment is festal?
I think it's a garment that you would use for a festival, a celebrating garment. Yeah, nice clothes rather than work clothes. Yeah.
You pointed out to us the significance of garments in the whole story
yes,
of Joseph.
Yeah, right.
And this is the final
culmination
of that.
The last, maybe the last, I think it's the last, time garments come in. This comment is about the garment, the robe with sleeves that was brought to prove his death, the garment that was ripped off him by Potiphar's wife, the garments, the fine garments then that he was changed into when Pharaoh raised him to status, and now these garments. Yeah, thank you. And his last note to his brothers as he sends them back, kind of comic note, do not quarrel along the way. Yeah. And one other thing, when this is announced now to Jacob at the end of this chapter, your translation said he was faint. Or he fainted.
His heart fainted.
Yeah, mine says he was stunned. Somewhat less dramatic. His heart fainted. But when they convince him, they tell him more, and they convince him he was revived. I think this story has had a number of times when people have gone down to death and come back to life. From the very first time they throw Joseph in the pit. And then they lift him out of the pit to give him to the traitors. And then he goes down, presumably to his death, to Egypt, and is raised by the grace of God, or the blessings of God, to prominence there. He's thrown into jail and then comes out of that. Jacob says, I'm going to Sheol mourning, and now he's not going to go there mourning. He says, if Benjamin doesn't come back, I'm definitely going to Sheol. And for a moment it appears Benjamin will not come back, but he does. And now he just about dies with the word that Joseph is alive, but he's revived. When Joseph interprets what has happened here, he says, God sent me before you to preserve life. And I think we see in this story, as we see so often in Scripture, the way God is a power for life in the midst of a world of death. And in this story, we see the descent into death, or Sheol, or the pit, responded to with God working for life over and over again. Now, for... the question that you bring up, I'd like us to break into small groups and talk about this a little bit. See what you think has happened between Joseph and his brothers over the course of this testing. Have there been stages of reconciliation? Is there evidence of growth and change on the part of the brothers, or change on the part of Joseph? And what again is happening for Joseph? We've got the person who is controlling the whole set of events and setting this all up so elaborately to put the brothers in this uncomfortable position and see what they do. And we've got the Joseph who weeps when he sees Benjamin, who weeps when he hears them express their guilt, and who struggles with his emotions. So those are a couple of things to talk about. What is the process of reconciliation coming both from Joseph and from the brothers that we see through this elaborate testing that he puts them through? What do you learn about this conflict in Joseph, if anything? You know, what more insights do you have about that? Let's try that in groups of three. When I do this with my confirmation classes, after about 30 seconds, everybody's quiet. And when I used to teach, and my college students would be discussing a poem or something, I'd give them a brilliant question with endless possibilities. You know, after 2 or 3 minutes, they'd be talking about the sports or something. So it's really delightful to have you going at it, and it's painful for me to cut you off. But there's more time after this hour, but I thought we ought to share some of the insights that you're coming up with now toward the end. What do you think? What do you see in here about the reconciliation process? Is that what's happening, or in what ways? What do you got for us?
Well, I think that one of the things that struck me is that Joseph, who is the person who announces absolution, pronounces absolution, who comes with the word of forgiveness, it is as, he wept aloud. The Egyptians heard it, the household of Pharaoh heard it, and then absolution is pronounced. In verse 5, mm-hmm. And do not be distressed or angry with yourself because you sold here for God sent me before you to preserve life. And I'm thinking how important it is in counseling with individual people or with a family or in congregations where transgression has taken place that this, and I think this is what this long story is about, that all of that has to be brought to voice and announced and shared, and then forgiveness and absolution can be announced. And how hard that is to wait out all of that story, all mm-hmm. of that confession,
mm-hmm.
But to wait it out, forgiveness, the absolution ought not to be declared ahead of time.
Right.
But that.
And that you feel Joseph doing that, waiting for a genuine confession.
Yeah, and how hard it is for him to wait it out.
Yeah.
Verse 2, wept aloud, the Egyptians heard.
Yeah.
He was the one that would come with the absolution.
Yeah, and especially you think back to the in an earlier chapter when the brothers are first before Joseph and he's giving them trouble, and they say, "This is because of what we did to our brother Joseph," and he might have regarded that as a kind of a confession and said, "Here I am. It's okay." But he waited.
Yeah.
He waited because that wasn't sufficient confession. Yeah, interesting. Okay. I think it's profoundly true about the need for something to be reconciled within the brothers, that they have to go through the process of genuine confession. And if that's what's happening here when Judah speaks, then that's
something. Or even genuine acceptance of they didn't turn on Benjamin and blame him for having the cup.
Right. They collectively took the responsibility for that as a family, rather than singling out the one that could easily have been singled out, which is remarkable. you know, even if they had been an ideal family up to this time, it would be kind of surprising to see this happen. Yeah, good. What other kind of observations did you have? Your group? Well, here's one back here.
We had a division, and the division was, at what point in time did Joseph forgive the act of being sold into slavery?
Mm-hmm.
Did he forgive when he was down in Egypt 15 days, or a year later, or 5 years later? Or did he not forgive his brothers until he saw their repentance?
Mm-hmm.
And that's that was the point of our discussion,
right.
And we didn't resolve it. And
okay.
Some of us felt that
you feel there's
Joseph
any...
lived as a forgiving person during those years in Egypt, and some of us felt that it wasn't until he realized and put his brothers to the test that then he forgave them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he felt forgiveness in his heart for them.
Yeah. Yeah. What evidence from the story can you bring to either side of that argument? You must say. You know, it's one of the reasons it's hard to decide, because there's not any clear statement here. He forgave them. Until this statement that Roy's mentioned.
I think it's right here. I think it's right here. When we bring all this to voice, that's when it takes place.
Mm-hmm.
I think that actually it shows that forgiveness itself is a process, and it takes an incredible amount of time, where he chose to name his children in the light of forgiveness. That was a step that he was aiming to forgive, but in the very act of doing it, couldn't. And then his actual acceptance of his brothers at this point carries that trial and that long trail of forgiveness through the years.
That the reference to the naming of the child is, he names his first child to forget. God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. And we did talk a little bit about that the other day, how forgetting is not quite the same as forgiving. It's an attempt, perhaps, to forget and put aside the father's house. And then when they come to him, it might be at that point when he's confronted with the need to ask whether he can forgive them or not. But another person could, I can see the argument that all of this has to do with something for the brothers, but it's not part of his own movement toward forgiveness. And interesting question.
But living the abundant life here. If he had spent those 20-some years in prison, his forgiving heart might have been a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, 13 years in prison. He did spend 13 years in prison before he became favored by the Pharaoh. And though things seemed to go fairly well for him in prison, it was nevertheless prison, and it was nevertheless in exile in Egypt. And so, though we never get much of the hardship of that characterized in this story, one has to acknowledge it probably wasn't an easy life. Yeah.
I think we have to come back to the dreams. And it's Joseph's realization that the dreams he had as a child and the dreams that he could interpret for the baker and the steward, the dream he could interpret for Pharaoh, that this is where he could see the working out of God's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And when his brothers bowed before him, without a doubt, there was a realization this dream was right. It was God's
mm-hmm.
plan.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe through the realization of that, God enabled Joseph to totally forgive and then to receive the whole family.
Yeah.
And make their plans for their future.
Yeah. So you'd see, in terms of that question, you'd see that coming here as the brothers are before him. And he's going through this process of weeping.
All the way through must have been reassuring to him. Mm-hmm. Because when Pharaoh's dreams were interpreted, that he would realize that God was with him to help him divine these dreams. This was a gift that he had. Mm-hmm. Even though he says later that when the silver cup, he says it's through that cup that I divine. I think that's kind of a playful thing with his brothers. I think in his own heart he's beginning to see that this interpretation of dreams is God's gift and part of God's leading.
Yeah, right.
But it's that cup. Just today, it hit me the connection of the cup, offering the cup of forgiveness, you know, bringing us into Christ offering the cup.
Mm-hmm.
First asking, will this cup pass from me? And then, you know, that word cup all of a sudden took on new ideas for me today. And was he, in a way, starting to offer forgiveness by putting that cup in Benjamin's sack?
That was before the institution of the Lord's Supper, but it could be in God's plan.
Yeah, that's just a connection.
Yeah.
Well, it is an interesting connection of the Old and New Testament, I think. But what I was wondering in this forgetting process, which somebody said takes years, in practicing the Christian faith, while you're in process of dealing with someone else who has sinned against you, do you continue to go to communion? You do go to communion and commune.
Are you asking?
Yes.
Yes, I would say yes indeed. One, we all come to communion as sinners in some kind of process. As we heard at devotions this morning, if a person is not in a process between some, I can't remember what the movement was, but it had to do with moving from sin to forgiveness or broken life to a more fulfilled life or faithful life, that one wasn't a Christian. That's so I suppose, but at any rate, I would say one is always, all baptized Christians are welcome and properly prepared for the Lord's table. That's a real different perspective than you'd have heard from most pastors 30 or 40 years ago, I know.
Yes, that's what I thought. I was almost afraid to go to communion here. I had not cleansed myself completely when I was confirmed and just 14 years of age.
Yeah.
It was almost terrifying for me to go to communion.
Okay. The bell has rung, and I just want to say as a final word that our lives are filled with moments. If I shouldn't say filled, our lives often have moments in them where we feel, as Jacob did, that we're going to be mourning something until our death, or that we are at the brink of death under the pressure of this guilt or evil or external pressures or misfortunes. And we see in this story repeatedly how God has brought life into situations of death. And God promises to do that always for us too, when we, regardless of how hopeless or desperate our circumstances may seem to us, and we certainly see the most extreme kind of circumstances in this story, God is capable of bringing life into that situation and restoration and renewal. And that is what I want you to take with you from this story today and always.